Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 67, One Emperor, One God. We left off last time in the autumn of 324 with a victorious Constantine as the sole master of the Roman Empire. When Constantine defeated Maxentius 12 years earlier, his government began to follow a public program of presenting the emperor's new religion as a sort of generic monotheism all his subjects could support. While making clear in his letters and battle standard his new religious affiliation, the emperor and his officials were keen to be diplomatic towards the majority pagan population of the empire. The imperial mints still issued coins with traditional religious imagery, and official documents used vague language referencing the highest deity. Only slowly did the emperor's self-presentation become more overtly Christian. By 324, this transition was complete. Not only had the emperor become more mature in his new faith, but he now no longer had any imperial rivals to contend with. Undefeated and supreme in his power, Constantine could now pursue any religious policy he wanted. Whatever his earlier understanding of his relationship to the Christian religion, it is clear at this stage that Constantine possessed a deep sense of mission and destiny. The Christian God had chosen him to rescue his church from persecution and liberate the entire Roman world from tyranny. Most importantly, the emperor believed his ultimate mission was to convert the Roman Empire to Christianity. For the remainder of his reign, that mission would drive much of Constantine's religious policy. The emperor soon dispatched two letters to the provinces of the East. The first was addressed specifically to his Christian subjects, and the second toward the majority pagan provincial populations as a whole. In the second letter, much of which reads like a speech, Constantine opens by praising the martyrs and condemning their persecutors. He recounts how he began his reign on the British island and had, by God's grace, delivered all regions, culminating in the East, from tyranny. The legal stipulations of the letters repealed the anti-Christian policies of Licinius. Catholic clergy regained all their curial exemptions from civic liturgies. All Christians who had suffered exile, forced labor, or imprisonment in the past year were released and returned home. Discharged Christian soldiers were restored to their former rank. The confiscated property of those martyred under Licinius was ordered to be restored to their next of kin, or, if no surviving kin remained, the local church. All other Christian or church property confiscated was ordered to be restored at once and without compensation, even for the imperial fisc. In contrast to the property restitution which had followed the Great Persecution, Constantine refused to compensate any pagans who were in possession of confiscated Christian property, regardless of how they had acquired it. From the emperor's standpoint, they should have known better than to profit off the renewed persecution of their neighbors these past months. Instead, the emperor allowed pagans to gain pardon if they admitted to acquiring such property. Following this letter, Constantine turned his legislation toward the imperial administration. The emperor forbade any imperial officials from sacrificing and discouraged them from worshipping idols. Animal blood sacrifice, so commonly associated with the persecutions of the past, would no longer be part of the Roman government or military. Eusebius of Caesarea, in his panegyrical biography of the emperor, also claims Constantine began to show preference for Christians in his choice of governors and other high-ranking officials. The extent of this claim is debated by modern scholars, although there appears to be some element of truth to it. No doubt, many professionally minded men considered embracing the emperor's religion to be a smart career move. The emperor next issued instructions to both his governors and the Catholic bishops on building churches. As part of his mission to evangelize the Roman world, the emperor decreed no expense would be spared in the repair and expansion of existing churches and the construction of new ones. Bishops were directed to petition the local governor for public funds. The emperor's letters to the bishops seem to have been distributed through the metropolitans, the bishops of the provincial capitals. Eusebius, as metropolitan of Palestine, preserves the letter he received in his Life of Constantine. Eusebius also claims that, at the same time the laws on church buildings were issued, Constantine actually went so far as to forbid the creation of idols, the use of divination, and animal blood sacrifice in the Eastern Empire, the core foundational ways pagans communed with their gods, with sacrifice being the most essential. This claim is one of the most contested and debated statements of Eusebius. Did Constantine really outlaw traditional pagan worship in the East? Scholars inclined to believe Eusebius point to a law issued by one of Constantine's sons to the vicar of Italy, which references an earlier law of his father's banning sacrifice, a ban which was now to be extended to the West. Scholars skeptical of Eusebius suggest this later law refers instead to a sort of public sentiment of Constantine's rather than an actual law. However, in a way, it doesn't matter as much as we might think. Even scholars who do think Constantine outlawed pagan sacrifice acknowledge this law was never really enforced, either because there was so much immediate backlash against it, or because the emperor never really intended to enforce it in the first place. Remember, Roman emperors couldn't just issue a novel religious decree and expect strict provincial enforcement on the ground without actively enforcing it themselves. Recall the various lapses in the Great Persecution we discussed in earlier episodes. Constantine was also, as we've seen, a superbly skilled politician. Surely he knew that most of his subjects, even in the Greek East, were still pagans. Whatever the nature of his alleged ban on sacrifice, the emperor issued another letter to the eastern provinces which laid out his religious agenda in a more clear-cut fashion. This long letter, also preserved by Eusebius, again reads much like a speech, and at times a prayer to God. Constantine recounts the deeds of the wicked persecutors of the past, from Diocletian to Licinius, condemning them as savage, wicked men. When recounting how an oracle of Apollo moved Diocletian to begin the Great Persecution, Constantine refers to Apollo as a demon who spoke through a dark cavern to incite his predecessor against God's people. Quite a change from his early days in Gaul, when Constantine believed Apollo / Saul had appeared to him. The emperor praises God, declaring his loyalty to the Most High, and asking that the empire may be healed through his servant, the emperor. Constantine further denounces paganism and its shrines as sanctuaries of falsehood. Nevertheless, Constantine makes clear that although he regards Christianity as the one true faith, pagans are to be left alone and not harmed. Christians should not take the opportunity for reprisals, but rather leave their pagan neighbors be in the hope that they too will see the light and embrace the truth. Constantine's tolerance did have some limitations. All copies of the philosopher Porphyry of Tyre's tome against Christians were ordered to be destroyed, and possession of the text was made a capital offense. Porphyry's anti-Christian work had been pivotal in the lead-up to the Great Persecution, and seems to have experienced a fresh round of readership under Licinius. Eusebius found himself compelled to write apologetic works refuting it. Certain pagan shrines, which were especially offensive to Christians or sat on Christian holy sites, were ordered destroyed as well, something we'll discuss in more detail down the road. Even pagan religious practice was at times regulated by the emperor outside the government. When the predominantly pagan town of Hispellum petitioned for permission to build a new temple to the imperial cult, Constantine allowed them to do so on the condition that sacrifice would not be performed. These restrictions were limited and specific, however. More importantly, Constantine ordered officials to go around the eastern provinces and confiscate precious metals from the public temples. This gold and silver was melted down and used to fund the new church buildings, as well as replenish the imperial coffers and issue new coinage. So what are we to make of Constantine's religious policy? Historian Elizabeth de Geyser sees in Constantine's letter the influence of Lactantius and his principal belief that coercion cannot be used to produce religious faith. Constantine's experience with the Donatists had reminded him that Lactantius was right. Lactantius himself died not long after Constantine's victory, but his influence lived on. De Geyser describes Constantine's policy here as one of concord, a policy which, though tolerant of paganism, actively promoted Christianity with the expressed aim of steering all Romans towards faith in Christ. Some historians even see the year 324 as the year Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire, the year the age of the persecutions truly came to an end and the Christian Empire was born. In November of 324, Constantine took the first step in what was to be one of his most lasting and important legacies. The area around the Bosporus Strait was, by this time, well recognized as a strategic area guarding the choke point between Europe and Asia, as well as providing a close base of operations for defending both the Danube and eastern frontiers. This was partly why Diocletian had chosen to establish himself in the Bithynian capital of Nicomedia. Since defeating Licinius, Constantine's new residence had become Nicomedia as well. But the emperor had a vision for a new capital on the Bosporus. The small, nearby Greek city of Byzantium had caught his imagination. Licinius seems to have refortified the city prior to their second war, and Constantine and his son Crispus had taken it by land and sea. The emperor now planned to remake it as a new capital to replace Nicomedia and commemorate his victory over Licinius. However, unlike the imperial capitals of the Tetrarchy, this city would go beyond what had come before it, in both scale and ambition. It wouldn't just be a substitute for the old capital of Rome, it would be a new Rome, complete with a senate to match the old Roman senate. It would have a palace, hippodrome, forum, monumental buildings, seven hills, and everything else found in the Eternal City. Constantine's new capital would of course be named after himself, Constantinople. It's debated if Constantine originally called the city New Rome, or Constantinople, or both. Some historians regard New Rome as the original, official name, but argue Constantinople quickly became what the citizens of the empire called it. Others see Constantinople as the official name, with New Rome as a more informal title. Whatever the case, Constantinople would soon become not just an important imperial center, but an important center of the Christian world as well. Much of the precious metal confiscated from pagan temples would be used in building the new city, along with numerous works of art Constantine's officials had also confiscated from temples. On November 8, 324, Constantine conducted the formal religious ceremony to consecrate the ground around Byzantium for a new city. Naturally, this ritual excluded the normally present pagan sacrifice, making Constantinople the first Roman city ever founded without sacrifice. A significant departure, the magnitude of which is difficult for us to grasp today. As a side note, it seems the emperor also added his third son, Constantius II, to the Imperial College at this ceremony by investing the boy with the rank of Caesar. We'll come back to Constantinople after it's officially opened, but as I'm sure many of you know, the city will soon become a frequent location in our story. After beginning construction on his new city, the emperor returned to Nicomedia and then headed east. The Augustus seems to have been traveling to Antioch with plans to then visit Alexandria. His string of uninterrupted victories had already spurred him to make another failed attempt at resolving the Donatist schism. Around October, Constantine had dispatched a mission of Eastern clerics to Africa in the vain hope that perhaps bishops from the Greek East could settle the division. However, the emperor was soon made aware that a different conflict was already brewing among the Easterners, a conflict which utterly dwarfed the relatively provincial schism in Africa. This conflict was, of course, the Arian controversy. With the fall of Licinius and his ban on episcopal assemblies repealed, the battle between the supporters of Alexander and Arius had resumed. If the emperor was still flushed with his victory and subsequent enthusiasm to promote the Christian faith, the Arian crisis brought him crashing back down to earth. Right at the moment the empire had been unified, the Catholic Church, whose prayers and worship were meant to sustain the peace of God, was at war with itself. While he was heading east, word reached Constantine of the dissension in Alexandria between Alexander and Arius. The emperor issued a letter addressed jointly to both the bishop and presbyter, exhorting them to embrace forgiveness and reconciliation. As far as the emperor was concerned, the issue which had sparked the controversy was an obscure point of theology, hardly worthy of the massive odium it had raised. Certain mysteries in the scriptures were not meant to be expounded upon. Alexander had gone too far in asking for his presbyters to give their opinions, and Arius was wrong for so forcefully pushing his own view. The emperor entrusted the letter to Osius of Cordova and dispatched the Spanish bishop to Alexandria to settle the dispute. By the time Osius arrived in the Egyptian capital, however, the situation had deteriorated further. The real conflict wasn't even between Alexander and Arius anymore, but between Alexander and Eusebius of Nicomedia. The bishop of the Eastern Imperial capital seems to have used his political connections to make a good impression on his new sovereign. His relative, Julius Julianus, the Praetorian prefect of Licinius, was honored by Constantine and was even made ordinary consul the following year. Eusebius was also still close to the emperor's sister Constantia, who, despite the fall of her husband, remained influential with her brother. Eusebius seems to have summoned a synod in Bithynia shortly after Constantine's victory, probably in part to impress the emperor. More importantly, Eusebius used the synod to resume his politicking on behalf of Arius and bring pressure on Alexander to make peace with the exiled presbyter. Peace within the church, exactly what the emperor wanted to hear, and what he hoped Osius would achieve. For his part, though, Osius became a staunch supporter of Alexander. Despite the emperor wanting peace and a resolution, his chief ecclesiastical advisor came to the conclusion that Arius had been rightly condemned as a heretic, and that Alexander's theology represented the Orthodox faith. A council was convened in Alexandria in late 324 during Osius's stay. Among those present were Alexander's clergy, as well as clergy from the Mareotis district, the area around Lake Mareot, just to the west of Alexandria. Following Williams's chronology, it seems this council was the occasion for Alexander's second major encyclical, which was addressed to all the bishops of the Catholic Church. The letter unequivocally condemns Eusebius of Nicomedia, Arius, and Arius's followers, sounding the alarm that the faith of the church is being perverted. This encyclical shows a greater degree of understanding of Arian theology, and provides a more sophisticated and concise refutation. The reason for this is because Alexander delegated the composition of the letter to his right-hand man, a young deacon named Athanasius. Yes, that Athanasius. There was one overture to the emperor's desire for unity at the council. The schismatic presbyter and self-appointed bishop, Caluthus, who had used the conflict with Arius to further separate himself from Alexander, was reconciled to the Church of Alexandria. Caluthus shared with Alexander an opposition to Arius, and the council readmitted him into communion as a presbyter. The Alexandrian encyclical was sent out from Egypt and Osius seems to have dutifully relayed these developments back to the emperor. However, before his return to the imperial court, events in Syria caused the Spanish bishop to make a stop in Antioch. To understand why, we need to address the situation in the Syrian capital. The bishop of Antioch, Philogonius, had been a key ally of Alexander, especially because Syro-Palestine had become something of a battleground between the two alliances, and control of the chief see of Syria was vital in this contest. Philogonius died in December of 324, and thus the see of Syria was now vacant. It seems that those Syrian bishops sympathetic to Arius wanted to translate Paulinus of Tyre to the Antiochian bishopric, whereas the partisans of Alexander backed the fiercely anti-Arian bishop of Berea, modern-day Aleppo, Eustathius. Conflict between the two factions was well underway, and it seems the strife in Antioch caused the emperor to also cancel his planned visit. In fact, a slightly different version of the letter Constantine sent to Alexandria was probably also addressed to the Antiochians specifically, and the Eastern churches more generally. It's unclear if a council to elect a successor was already underway, or if Osius summoned one when he arrived. Regardless, in early 325, Osius presided over a council in Antioch consisting of 59 bishops. The council quickly ensured Eustathius became the new bishop. A creed was drawn up, which basically espoused the theology of Alexander of Alexandria as Catholic Orthodoxy, and anathematized anyone who believed the Son was a creature or confessed a trinity of three distinct essences, or ousia. For rejecting this creed, three of Arius's supporters were provisionally excommunicated: the Cilician bishop Narcissus of Neronius, the Syrian Theodotus of Laodicea, and our church historian Eusebius of Palestinian Caesarea. Not surprisingly, Eusebius utterly fails to mention this council in his voluminous writings. With things wrapped up in Antioch, Osius and the council sent out an encyclical communicating their decisions, and the Spanish bishop proceeded back to the imperial court. The reason the three excommunications at Antioch had been provisional was because something much larger was in the works. Osius and the Council of Antioch had declared that Eusebius, Theodotus, and Narcissus would be given the opportunity to recant and be reinstated at the forthcoming synod at Ancyra in Galatia. The emperor had determined to put a definitive end to the entire controversy by summoning all the bishops of the East to a great general council. It's possible that, just before Licinius banned church councils, Alexander had already been planning a general synod to meet at Ancyra in order to depose Eusebius of Nicomedia and ratify the condemnation of the Arians. If so, then the emperor commandeered these plans in the interest of promoting peace between the two parties. Ancyra was the provincial capital of Galatia, and you may recall had been the location of a regional council in the aftermath of the Great Persecution. The bishop of the city was an ally of Alexander and Osius, and a staunch opponent of Eusebius of Nicomedia. This bishop's name was Marcellus, and we will have much more to say about him in the future. However, as the spring of 325 approached, the emperor called an audible and informed the bishops that the venue had been changed. Instead, a new city was decreed from the province of Bithynia. The emperor justified the change on the grounds that Western clerics from Italy and other parts of Europe would be attending, and that the climate at this new venue was much more warm and pleasant. This was all true, however, more crucial was the city in question's close proximity to the emperor's current residence of Nicomedia. He would be able to attend the council's sessions in person and monitor its progress. Today, this city is known as Iznik in Turkey, but in Roman times it was called Nicaea. And so, As May of 325 approached, bishops from all over the Greek East began making their way to Nicaea for the Great Synod. Next episode, we finally arrive at this seminal event in the history of Christianity, the Council of Nicaea, an event which would later become known as the First Ecumenical Council of the Christian Church.